Welcome to a Preakness Week edition of the Thoroughbred Daily News TDN Riders Podcast. I'm Bill Finley. I'm a correspondent for the Thoroughbred Daily News. You can catch me every Saturday from 10 to 2 Eastern on SiriusXM Radio, along with Dave Johnson on Down the Stretch.
Look forward to that. I am Randy Moss with NBC Sports here trackside, basically behind the grandstand by the Stakes Barn in an ugly NBC trailer at an old hilltop, guys.
I'm Zoe Cadman with Fast Racing, and I'm here in the Sheraton in Baltimore. So we're both here, Randy. They might have to get tied on.
I want to remind you that the TDN Riders Room podcast is brought to you each week by Keeneland. So let's get right into the Preakness, guys. And there's a couple different storylines, one of which is the obvious one, only one horse coming back from the Kentucky Derby in Mage. But let's save that topic for a little bit later in the show, because we're going to talk about something that is now very relevant, whether or not it's time to change the Triple Crown structures, mainly the spacing between the races. So let's just look at this race like we did from the Derby. I don't think we need to go down each and every horse, but an overview of the race. And the way I see it, Mage is clearly on paper the best horse. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt about that. He's got the 105 buyer in the Derby, where he beat what will be a much tougher field than what he's facing in the Preakness on Saturday. Can he do it again? I guess if he runs back to his Derby performance, I think he will win, Randy. But, you know, there are the questions of the 2 weeks, how it's going to affect him. Also a horse that, again, we were talking about, they were asking a lot of him in the Kentucky Derby because he hadn't raced more than three times, hadn't raced as a two-year-old. You know, is this perhaps the race where it catches up with him? You know, we'll find out on Saturday, but you don't have to be a genius to predict that he's going to be the solid favorite in here. And quite frankly, the most likely winner by a wide margin, I would say.
Based on the most recent efforts of all the horses, yes, I would agree with that. But then the question becomes, which horses are capable of improving, like Mage did in his numbers dramatically in the Kentucky Derby? Which horses, might Mage be susceptible to regression a little bit? Since the pace was a really good setup for him, a surprisingly fast pace in the Kentucky Derby, probably, and I say that with emphasis because the Derby pace was a surprise, but probably he won't get that kind of a pace in the Preakness, even though there does seem to be some legitimate speed. So, yeah, I agree with you that on paper, based on their most recent races, Mage's Kentucky Derby stands out. But as we all know, races usually aren't run that simplistically.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. And on paper, he's the best horse. And you know what's really interesting about this is that it was a few years ago, I had a conversation with Bob Baffert, who's the equal winningest Preakness trainer in history with 7 to his name. And I said, how come you always win the Preakness with the horse you win the Derby with? Because he invariably seems to win the Preakness. Now, he might not always win the Triple Crown, but he does it. And he said, it's simple. I've got the best horse. And that, if you have the best horse in the Derby, now not always does the best horse win the Derby, but generally the best horse in the Derby will be the best horse in the Preakness. And if that is the actual case, then he should win. And you know, some horses handle it very easily. You come back, you do an easy half-mile work or you 2-minute lick. You don't really have to do anything. You don't have to overthink anything. If your horse was primed and ready to run in the Kentucky Derby and everything's okay with him, he should be fine to run in the Preakness if he's the best horse. And we'll have to see if Mage is the best horse. On paper, yes. There are others in there, like First Mission, who draws the outside, who's got a tremendous resume, much like Mage, and he didn't have the grueling run 2 weeks ago in the Preakness. So he's definitely knocking on the door for trainer Brad Cox. But I thought it was really interesting to listen to Bob. You know, if you've got the best horse in the Derby, that's why, and that's his perspective and his training regime. And that's why he has been so successful in having the Derby winner come back and win the Preakness.
And, you know, sometimes we tend to make these things too complicated. Who's the best horse? As Zoe pointed out, it's the Derby winner. I mean, there's really no doubt about that. Okay, so team, let's all come up, though, with an alternative. If he's not going to win, who is going to beat him? And I got a kind of an out-of-the-box theory here. How about Perform? Randy, this is heresy if you're a Beyer fan, because his last figure was 20 points slower than Mage. He ran an 85 in the Federico Tessier. But first of all, there's no bigger Shug McGahee fan than I am. And why would Shug McGahee be running him in this race? We have to pay $150,000 to supplement him. You know, I don't know how much it's Shug, how much is the owners, but that is a huge vote of confidence. And do yourself a favor, folks. Go back and look at his Federico Tessio. Who did he beat? Probably nobody. The number's no good, but it was very impressive. This horse in the 316th pole didn't have a prayer. He was blocked on the inside under Fergal Lynch, and somehow he won the race. So to me, he's a horse that's going to improve. I might have to improve 15 lengths to beat Mage, but there's my kind of wise guy horse. What do you guys got?
I'm right in there with you, Bill. Take your flare pin on the past performances next to that 85. Just put plus next to that, because Perform only got to run a 16th of a mile in the Tessio and just absolutely ran over horses toward the end. And it is important, I think, to read between the lines, knowing the conservative nature of Shug McGahee, that he would recommend to the owners that they put up $150,000 to supplement this horse. And he was a maiden at the beginning of March, so he is really trending in the right direction, and I think he is a legitimate long shot chance. But it's not just him. For example, National Treasure. He's got blinkers on, he's got the rail. He's almost certainly going to go to the lead. Now, can you confidently play National Treasure against Mage based on the races that we've seen this year for National Treasure and maybe even a couple of races last year? No. But as we all know, some horses get brave and some horses run their best races when they're in front. And with the blinkers on and probably the lead in the rail if he breaks with Johnny V, there is the distinct possibility that National Treasure is going to run maybe a lifetime best. Now, is that good enough to beat Mage? If Mage regresses a little bit from the Kentucky Derby with the 2 weeks and with the slightly softer early fractions, maybe? Yes, entirely a possibility. And as Zoe pointed out, First Mission is going in the right direction as well with Brad Cox. And despite Irad Ortiz's best efforts in the Lexington Stakes, he managed to win that race anyway and seems to be a horse that's really just like performing, trending upward.
Yeah, you know, it's not a one-horse race. It's people are moaning and bitching that it's not a good race. I think it's a good race because it's fairly evenly matched. Now, I'm going to throw one out and you're going to be like, oh my God, the horses that beat him, they're just awful. But Blazing Sevens, okay, so Tappet Trees beat him. He didn't run anywhere. Verified beat him. He didn't run anywhere. He was third to the pair of them in the Bluegrass. Chad Brown has pointed him specifically to this race. Now, I've not seen him in the flesh at Pimlico, but boy, I've seen him galloping over the track there. And hubba, hubba, does he look damn good. Comes in with a very, very good work at Belmont Park. You can find that on XBTV. Quick plug there. Gets Irad Ortiz. I don't know if he's good enough, but just everything's leaning me towards Blazing Sevens. I love Perform. Just purely after watching that race back, he could have won by an absolute pole if he'd wanted to. And I'm a big Shuggy fan as well. And First Mission is going to get tested. And then you got National Treasure on the rail with Bob Baffert, his first runner in the Triple Crown in 2 years. You don't think he doesn't want to win this? It's going to be a terrific race. I'm not sure what kind of price we're going to get on any of these, but I'm really looking forward to it.
Now, speaking of Bob Baffert, the day before is the Black Eyed Susans. He's got the heavy favorite Faiza, and this is a horse, you know, in all honesty, the Kentucky Oaks just was kind of a race without a lot of sizzle. And part of the reason was that the best three-year-old filly in the country, who is Faiza, was not in that race. And, you know, we know the backstory and the politics and the bad blood between owner Michael Lund Peterson and Churchill Downs over the Baffert one. Zoe, you've been a big Faiza fan from day one. She looks awful hard to beat in there. How good is she?
Oh, she's good. She is really good. And honestly, I'm not sure she's been any better. She's always been the kind of filly. She didn't wow you as a two-year-old. She was just okay as a two-year-old, but her last race was absolutely terrific. Watching her in the paddock that day, and I even said to Bob right after it, I'm like, boy, like she was actually animated. Usually she comes out like an old donkey. She's got her head down and she's just walking along and she just does just enough to win by a head or a neck or whatever it is. She came out and she won by 6.5. And she came bouncing onto that racetrack and looked like a different filly that we've seen before. Even Bob was like, oh, I was a little worried in the paddock because I've never seen her so animated. So I think she's just now coming into her own. I really, really do.
I agree that it took that her absence took a lot of luster out of the Kentucky Oaks. I mean, when the best three-year-old filly in training is in training and is healthy and can't run in the Kentucky Oaks, then that obviously is a sort of a black mark on the race. And the owner, Michael Lund Peterson, has said he wants to be loyal to his team. He said that everything that he's accomplished in racing has been because of Bob Baffert, which is why he didn't want to transfer Faiza to another trainer to be eligible to run in the Kentucky Oaks. So this is basically Faiza's Kentucky Oaks. And Michael Lund Peterson lives in Baltimore. So this is kind of a special situation for him as well. I think she's an absolute standout. Merlaza is interesting to me, trained by Brad Cox, coming off a win at Oaklawn in the Valley of the Vapors Stakes. I don't think she's as good as Faiza, but if you go back and watch that race, it's not perform, okay? But Merlaza was trapped in the middle of a pack of in a really slow-paced race at Oaklawn, going a mile, which is a short stretch, ending at the 16th pole. And she couldn't get out. I mean, she was stuck, and she was a little bit keen and wanting to go. The pace was so slow and couldn't go anywhere. I believe it was Joelle Rosario that was on her that day. Yes, it was. She was 3 lengths off the pace or so. And he finally got out at the quarter pole. So that's a short run to the 16th pole, to the finish, and whoosh. She just rushed by horses, not top level horses, although they weren't bad. So to me, that's a pretty good exacta. Faiza and Merlaza in the Black Eyed Susan.
That was the Santa Anita Oaks that she won, and she was terrific. And I can remember having a conversation with Michael Lund Peterson. He's like, this is my Kentucky Oaks, the Santa Anita Oaks. He's like, I'll see you in Baltimore. And that was the plan from the get-go. So everything has just worked out fine, and he's going to be super excited. That was the first time he'd ever actually watched her run in person, and he was beside himself. He was just absolutely delighted. It was cool.
All right, we'll see how Faiza does in the Black Eyed Susan. Hey, Joey, what's going on with Keeneland?
Well, we're going to talk about the world's biggest yearling sale. Of course, the TDN Writers' Room is brought to you by Keeneland. The September Keeneland Yearling Sale returns on September the 11th through the 23rd. Learn more at theworldsyearlingsale.com. And don't forget that 4 Keeneland sales graduates are all running in the Preakness. We have Mage, Blazing Sevens, Chase the Chaos, and Perform. We'll be right back after this message from Keeneland.
If this place could talk, it would roar. It would say, this is racing. This beating heart in the heart of horse country. Steady and strong beneath the roar. Reminding us why. For the love of the horse. For generations to come.
Maximum Security proves he's the real deal with a gate-to-wire win in the Florida Derby.
Champion 3-year-old.
Maximum Security has won the TBG.com Haskell Invitational.
11 triple-digit buyers.
Maximum Security, he smoked them in the cigar mile.
Grade 1 winning 4-year-old.
Maximum Security takes them all the way in the TBG Pacific Classic.
Secure your mare's future. Maximum Security.
Justify's Rebellious Stage, a $450,000 Keeneland September yearling purchase for the BSW Crow Colts Group, won his debut by 7 lengths at Pimlico on Saturday and he looked absolutely terrific. He was trained by Brittany Russell. Meanwhile, Mendelsohn also had an eye-catching winner at Churchill Downs on Saturday when his three-year-old filly Cecile came from last to first on the Churchill turf to get up for a half-length win. And over in France, Vive la France. We'll talk to the French a little bit later on with Remy and Peb. Uncle Mo was the sire of the third most expensive juvenile at the Arcana Breeze-Up Sale on Saturday when Jamie McCalmont, Billy the Kid to his friends, went to €600,000 for the colt. Purchased on behalf of Coolmore, Jamie McCalmont told the TDN that the juvenile will be heading back to the U.S. where he'll join Todd Fletcher's bar.
Pimlico, a sister track of Santa Anita. Zoe Zoll's on top of all things Santa Anita. What's going on? First things first, Zoe.
First things first, I got to catch up with a new jockey, another Italian. It was just about 6 weeks ago that I stood in this exact same place and caught up with Frankie Dettori and Mike Smith. And lo and behold, we have another Italian right here at Santa Anita. Antonio, tell us what led you to come here.
Well, I've always been following American racing, and but since unfortunately my country, the racing is not having a great time, you know.
No.
So I wanted to make a move. I'm very ambitious, and I thought American racing could be a good move.
Well, so you come over specifically riding for Doug O'Neill, but you've been here not even 2 weeks. You've already won five races.
Yeah, I'm being blessed, lucky.
Even on the dirt. I mean, lo and behold, an Italian can ride on the dirt.
Well, in the last 7 years, I was riding a lot dirt races in Dubai. So let's say I have an advantage because of that.
So who's your agent?
My agent here is Tom Canust.
Good guy. He's
a good guy. I think he's working really hard. And I got this winner because of him. You know, he put me on the right horses at the right time. So it's very nice to work for him. And let's see what future holds for us.
How's this over here? Because we ride a little lighter over here. Are you hungry yet?
You know, it's a long time. I didn't have any pasta and pizza, so.
So you joined a gym, right?
Yes, I have a gym right next to my house, and I go pretty much every day.
You want to do some push-ups? Come on.
Nah.
Come on.
We top touch?
Yeah. Ready? Ready? Ready?
Okay.
Ready? Ready?
How many? Not too many. I need
to
ride another
10.
Okay.
Ready? Go.
Go.
Awesome. Thank you so much. At Santa Anita Park, the Hollywood meet rolls on. We have a 1 p.m. post on Preakness Saturday with the gates opening at 7:15 a.m. for simulcasting. Don't forget the $1,500 Preakness Stakes Challenge. Learn more at santaanita.com. All yours, Bill.
All right. So back to the other big subject, and it was a big subject last year with Rich Strike passing the Kentucky Derby. And once again, you know, there's only 8 horses in the race. It's, you know, it's a great race. It's the middle jewel of the Triple Crown, Grade One. There's a lot to be excited about. But the fact that only one horse is coming out of the Kentucky Derby, and that's Mage, and, you know, everybody else just heading to the sidelines after it's over, brings up the same subject we've been talking about for, you know, a good 15 years or so. Is it finally time to change the structure of the Triple Crown? I mean, there's two things you could talk about. Obviously, the timing between the races, and perhaps some people want to talk about the distances, but I'm more concerned with the timing between the races. For 100 years, I've been writing, do not change the Triple Crown. It's tradition, and I thought if a horse won a, what I called it, the Triple Crown Light, how could you stack up the winner of these races spread all over the calendar to the great horses that have won the Triple Crown over the years? But you know what? I've had enough. And I have totally gone over to the other side. And one of the reasons why I changed my mind, I'm a huge baseball fan. And I wrote this in the Thoroughbred Daily News. Baseball had a lot of problems, particularly that the fact that the games just took forever. I mean, you get 4-hour baseball games. It was boring people to death. And they made radical changes. They didn't worry about tradition. They worried about, we got to make the game as good as possible. We got to make the product as good as possible. You know what? If baseball can do it, horse racing can do it. In 1979, the NBA initiated the three-point shot. I know that's a long time ago, but it completely changed the game of basketball. It was a radical change. The NBA has never been more popular, and all they do is shoot three-pointers in this day and age. So, Randy, I don't know where you stand on this, but I'm throwing in the towel, waving the white flag. Damn it, change the Triple Crown.
You may be the only one that doesn't know where I stand on this because I've been ad nauseum. I've been playing this violin now for about 15 years. As far as I'm concerned, we're about 10 years too late, and we don't know when it's going to get changed, assuming it does get changed to begin with, you know? How about that? Andy Beyer and Bill Finley were two of the last of the Mohicans, and Andy Beyer changed last year, and now Bill Finley has seen the light here. Look, let me just say one more thing about it, and there's so many things I could, you know, get back on my soapbox again, but people are getting tired of hearing it. Tradition, okay? Tradition is the main reason to change the spacing. Tradition, the tradition of the Triple Crown is simple. The best three-year-olds, the best horses of the generation run in the Derby, and then they run in the Preakness, and then they run in the Belmont. And that's the ones that are left run in the Belmont, which is a mile and a half test of the champion, right? That's what has made the Triple Crown so special. That is the tradition. The best three-year-olds run in all three races. It's not happening. It hasn't been happening for quite a while. We need to get back to the tradition. And the way to do that is, spacing hasn't always been the way it is right now. It's been since 1969. But it would improve the Triple Crown series dramatically. People say, oh, you're making it too easy to win. It'll make it tougher to win because you got to beat the best horses in the Preakness as well as the Kentucky Derby. You got to come right back and beat him again. Two Phils would be the favorite in the Preakness Stakes if he were here. Angel of Empire would be right there with Mage in the betting. Anyway, I'm not going to keep pounding this, but I'm glad you've come over, Bill.
Zoe?
I'm just like climbing up to get Randy off of his soapbox and just like pull him back down here. Randy, you're right. Bill, I'm glad I can go back to baseball games. Thanks for that. Now I know it's not going to take 4 hours and all the Jesus out of me. I do like going to Cubs games, so I will always take a ticket to Wrigley Field if anyone ever wants to take me. But yeah, you know, it's with the scratch of Forte Derby Day, you know, 20 years ago, Empire Maker ran with a bruised foot and ran second. The times are changing, right? So Forte wouldn't have been scratched 20 years ago, not saying it was right or wrong, or I believe he probably should have been scratched, but he would have been able to run 20 years ago. He'd have come back on 2 weeks rest and such forth. But perhaps it is time for a change. I mean, I've been resistant to it myself just because I've borne witness to some absolute brilliance in Southern California. And I'm so lucky to have been able to watch American Pharoah and Justify train pretty much every single day. So I know it takes brilliance. And that wasn't that long ago for these horses to show their brilliance. So that has made me second guess it. But Randy, you're absolutely right. We need better horses to run in this race. I believe this year is going to be a very good competitive race, but it's not the cream of the crop. But I'm still a little bit torn after having witnessed Justify and American Pharoah be so brilliant. And there's only been 15 Triple Crown winners.
Well, if you had the Preakness on Memorial Day weekend this year, okay, you would probably have Mage, Two Phils, Angel of Empire, Disarm, Forte, maybe Confidence Game, maybe Tap It Trice and Derma Sotogake.
Oh, yeah, I'm National not disagreeing with you.
National Treasure, First Mission. Now, how much of a better race would that be than the Preakness we have right now? Not that this is a terrible race. It's the Preakness, the second leg of the Triple Crown. I love the Preakness. It's fantastic. But look at how much better it would be. How much better
and
it
I'm
could be.
And I'm agreeing with you. I am definitely agreeing with you here. And it is a time for change. I remember when this first came up a couple of weeks ago, I can't for the life of me remember who it was on Twitter. But they posted each like grade one three-year-old race every month. I'm like, oh, that would be cool. The first Saturday in every month and just like took you all the way through the end of the year. So I don't know what the answer is. And perhaps times are changing. You know, It's time. I'm going to climb up and join you on your soapbox. Is
there
room?
You go. Yay, Zoe. Now, some people just said make it 3 weeks between the Derby and Preakness. That wouldn't do you any good. I don't think that would make a big change. I'm with Zoe in what she said. I would make it the first Saturday of each month. The first Saturday in May, first Saturday in June, first Saturday in July, which wouldn't always mean 4 weeks. And sometimes it would mean five. Randy, one question I have that perfect question for you. This is never going to happen if the networks don't give their blessing. Now you have two partners in NBC and Fox. What's your take on that, particularly NBC? Would they be on board with this?
Well, NBC would totally be on board with moving the Preakness. If there is a fly in the ointment here, it's NYRA. It's the New York Racing Association, because right now the Belmont Stakes is the beneficiary of the weakness of the Preakness Stakes because of the spacing, because so many horses, as we've seen, run in the Derby, skip the Preakness, wait for the Belmont. That obviously wouldn't happen if there were 8 or 9 weeks between the Kentucky Derby and the Belmont. I asked Todd Fletcher about this last year. I said, what's your opinion on this? And he kind of took a deep breath and said, I've probably been the one that's benefited the most from this. But having said that, I think it's probably time to make a change in the spacing for the good of the Triple Crown and the good of the sport. But I'm not sure, and it's horse racing, unfortunately, it's the state of the game. I'm not sure NYRA would make the change willingly. I think maybe the only way you would see it happen is for First Racing to unilaterally move the Preakness and then basically force NYRA to move the Belmont Stakes at that point. I hope it wouldn't have to come down to that kind of conflict, that cooler heads could prevail and that NYRA could see that this is for the good of the sport. Mm-hmm. But I fear that might be a road we would have to go down.
Right. Okay. Well, speaking of Rich Strike, who passed the Preakness last year, he was back in the news. This was an unusual, odd story. Trainer Eric Reed resigned as the trainer of Rich Strike because he got in a dispute with owner Rick Dawson over a movie they're making about Eric Reed. And he says it's primarily about him and his father and the relationship. And it's just sort of a little bit about Rich Strike. I'm paraphrasing, maybe putting words into his mouth. But Rich Strike, Dawson, as of Tuesday when we're taping this, is not announced yet, will be his new trainer. Just a strange story. Who's going to play Eric Reed in the movie? Produced by Peyton Manning, by the way.
Look, we've all seen so many instances, even with good horses like Seattle Salute, where the trainers and the owner have a conflict, have a falling out, they don't get along for various reasons. I mean, heck, Penny Tweedy was super hard on Lucien Lauren, put so much pressure on him. She wasn't the easiest in the world to deal with. But this is something new. I mean, this is like next level craziness. I mean, I don't know if you have a better idea about this, Zoe, but I got no clue what's going on here.
I have Trump plan. No, I got no idea. They'll figure it out. And I like Eric. Eric's a good guy. I don't know. I can't think of anyone that. Well, I'm sure we'll come up with someone that could play him.
But, he would probably say Brad. Yeah.
Brad, there you go.
Right.
Or Tom Cruise. How about that? Kind of a silly story in the middle of all the controversy that's going on in racing. And we'll find out what goes on with that as we progress. Want to remind you again about what's going on with the Penn Mile. And we are just 16 days away from the Grade 2 $400,000 Penn Mile at Penn National. The Penn Mile Day features 5 stakes races with almost $1 million in purses. Nominations close Wednesday, but right now some of the horses considering the race include Mo Stash, trained by Vicky Oliver, is the winner of the Grade 3 Transylvania at Keeneland's, fourth in the 2022 Breeders' Cup Juvenile Turf. How about Web Slinger, owned by our old friend John Green, winner of the Grade 2 American, John Green and his family, Len, of course, winner of the Grade 2 American Turf at Churchill Downs, third in the Transylvania. And Najirok, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, trained by Graham Motion, second in the Transylvania, third in the 2022 Breeders' Cup Juvenile Turf, winner of the Grade 3 Futurity at Belmont at Aqueduct. Also, Mike Maker is considering several horses for the race. You can't run a good turf race without Mike Maker. Pennsylvania stalwart Guadalupe Preciado has 3 ready for the Pennsylvania Bred Stakes on the undercard, including 4 De Sombra in the New Start Stakes. This race is named in honor of Penn National Aftercare Homing Program, funded by the Pennsylvania HBPA, which has rehomed over 1,000 horses from Penn National into second careers.
2023 marks the 10th celebration of Penn National's signature event, Penn Mile Night, Friday, June 2nd at Hollywood Casino at Penn National Racecourse. There are four Pennsylvania-bred stakes, each with a $100,000 purse, plus the $150,000 Penn Oaks. It's all capped off by the $400,000 Grade 2 Penn Mile, Friday, June 2nd at Penn National. First post, 5 p.m. For more, go to PAHPBA.com. The PA Horse Breeders Association presents the Pennsylvania Stallion Series. Six races for PA sire, PA bred two-year-olds at Parks. Two $100,000 contests at 5.5 furlongs. On August 21st, PA Day at the Races. September 23rd, PA Derby Day has two races at 6.5 furlongs, both with a $150,000 purse. And in December, two races going long, each worth $200,000. For more, go to PABred.com.
So on the topic of Pennsylvania, let's talk about Pennsylvania breds. This podcast, TDN Podcast, is also brought to you by the Pennsylvania Horse Breeders Association, the PHBA. We've been talking over the last few weeks about the Pennsylvania bred Angel of Empire leading up to the Kentucky Derby. And of course, he ran exceptionally well to finish third in the Derby, maybe going fastest of all at the finish. Good effort for that Pennsylvania bred. Well, guess what? We got another PA bred in the Preakness. He'll be a lot bigger prize than Angel of Empire. Chase the Chaos, trained by Ed Moser Jr. He's going to have to bounce back from a couple of dull efforts in his most recent races, and he'll be the longest shot on the board. But a Pennsylvania bred in with a shot again. Chase the Chaos in the Preakness Stakes, bred in Pennsylvania. The fastest horse of the week brought to you by the Fast Stallions at Windstar Farm, like this sire, who at one point was named a TDN Rising Star after he won at Saratoga by 11.5 lengths. We'll identify that stallion at Windstar shortly. But first, fastest horse of the week, drumroll please, Dr. Shibble, who won the allowance race on Saturday right before the San Luis Rey at Santa Anita. It was only a three-horse field, five entered, scratched down to three, but Dr. Shibble outran a pretty nice old pro in CZ Rocket, went essentially wire to wire and earned a buyer's speed figure of 105. It was the first start for Dr. Shibble since he ran at in Maidan in the Dubai Golden Shaheen of 2022, not 2023. He finished pretty good in that race. He finished third. Remember earlier in the Breeders' Cup sprint before that, he was beaten just a nose in the sprint. So a very, very talented sprinter. He was out because of bone bruising, but he bounced back in a big way to earn the fastest horse of the week mantle with that 105 buyer figure. We'll see where they wind up running Dr. Shibble next. Now, that Kentucky bred that we were talking about, standing stud at Windstar Farm, happens to be Nashville. Nashville would live up to that Rising Star tag by dominating a field of Keeneland in an allowance race in his second start. He ran the fastest six furlongs of the 2020 Keeneland meet. That was the COVID meet. He won a race at Oakland also in 108.61 for six furlongs, which was the fastest time at that track in 2 years. And remember that race on the Breeders' Cup undercard? It was a full second faster at six furlongs than the Breeders' Cup sprint wound up being run in. It's Nashville, speed, 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 standing at Windstar for a fee of $15,000. If you don't know by now, you should know. The Green Group is an accounting and tax consulting advisory firm. They specialize in the thoroughbred business. No one wants to pay more taxes than they have to pay. That's what makes the Green Group so good. For more information about the Green Group and to see how they can save you money, I sound like Jim McNamara, save you money, log on to www.grudco.com.
And welcome in now the Green Group guests of the week, the legendary Pierre Bullock. You know him as Peb, the longtime cartoonist for the Daily Racing Form, and his son, Remy Bullock, who is the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, a very good cartoonist in his own right, and he has been doing cartoons for the Thoroughbred Daily News, normally found every Friday in our publication. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to have a cartoon off What is a cartoon off? We're going to match the legendary Peb with his son, Remy. We're going to give them a subject. They're each going to do a cartoon. And then we're going to have the listeners and viewers of the TDN Writers Room decide whose was better. Matter of fact, if you are picked, you'll get the original cartoon. When we're done with the interview, we'll give you all the details, how to enter the contest. But this is quite a delight to have both of the Balak cartoonists here on the Thoroughbred Daily News podcast. And Peb, let's start with you. Going back to your history in this country, you came over here in 1954 at the bequest of John D. Shapiro to do cartoons for the Washington, D.C. International, which was a huge event back then. Can you tell us a little bit about that history and how you went from being in France to ultimately coming to Washington, D.C., to Laurel, and then becoming an American cartoonist?
Mr. Shapiro wanted me to come to visit. It was because of the Washington, D.C. International. That was the big race that was just starting the first year of that race, I think. So they invited me to come to America, but they were wondering how they could bring me here. What I find that a friend of mine had a place in a cargo with four horses that was coming for the Washington, D.C. International. So they said, if you want, you can take advantage of that thing. So I went to look on this cargo, and I was on a bale of hay in a cargo with the four horses in a on my nose. And this is where I come to America. It was absolutely wonderful. I end up in I forgot when we end up.
Probably in Baltimore.
Anyway, we came this way.
As a young boy showing up, what did you think of America as a young boy just landing fresh off the boat, flying, coming over the horses? What did you think?
On the plane.
Yeah.
Well, I was overwhelmed by everything, absolutely. And I was trying to struggle with my English, so that was something, because I had a teacher of English. My mother took care of me when I was 11. She put me in the hand of a mademoiselle. It was a Miss Courgeon. I see Miss Courgeon is she's the one that taught me how to speak English. And when the first time I came back to Maison Lafitte, what do I see in the street? Mademoiselle Courgeon. So I was so proud of my English. So I said to Mademoiselle Courgeon, hey, how are you? Hey, how is everything? And I wanted to show off. And she became red. She blushed and she, blah, 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 blah. She couldn't speak, And I was so sorry because I wanted to show off my English, to her, Mademoiselle Courgeon. I forgot. It was a lovely, lovely memory.
Now, Remy, my question for you is, not only are you very good at this as well, your style is very similar to your father's. Matter of fact, if you put the two cartoons together, I don't think people could tell who was who, which is Remy and which is Peb. Did this all just come naturally, or is this the result of your father sitting you down as a student, teaching you how to do this?
Well, I think, first of all, thank you. That's a great compliment. The answer to that question is, my father always said, listen, you're going to develop a style over time. The drawings that he drew in the early 50s were completely different than the drawings he's done lately. And it's the same thing with artwork. There's not 1,000 different ways to draw, funny horses with big bulgy eyes. So I have to start somewhere, and hopefully it kind of develops into its own style. I think it's also the type of humor you use, and so I've had a lot of influences of other cartoonists when I did political cartoons and things like that. It was a whole different realm. When it comes to equine related cartoons, though, it's hard to kind of get completely away from it. But hopefully, I can kind of, you know, build a style not just in the artwork but in the humor. I think probably. Well, listen, it's like having, you know, Rodney Dangerfield or Jerry Seinfeld as your father. It's hard to top that kind of humor. His cartoons were funny in the 70s and are still funny today. Mine might be more topical to what's happening currently in racing and all that. It's kind of really, I do get a little bit of influence from a guy named Gary Larson, who used to do The Far Side. I loved his work too. So I try to kind of blend things a little bit. And then eventually I hope to have a completely unique style.
Well, guys, I should have said this right from the start. It is an absolute pleasure to meet the pair of you on screen at the same time. Remy, I've been a fan of yours, Peb, when I first got off my plane from England. One of the first few things I saw in the Daily Racing Form was a Peb cartoon. And I'm like, this is amazing. So I bow down to the pair of you. But Peb, how did this all start? How did you start cartooning?
Well, I always tried to copy from the newspapers when I was a kid, you know. I was copying cartoons. And that was my ambition to draw. I make albums of a caricature of politicians. I get albums full of those things, you know. And I had a great passion for that. As a matter of fact, my father was a head lad in a stable where we had the little stable in the back, and my mother and my family was living above the horses.
Wow.
In the kitchen, and you know, we were living right above the row of horses, and so on summer I would put my table outside, and I would start drawing all kind of. I drew a series of sketches that, you know, I was like 12 or something like that, but I was drawing a race from start to finish.
Oh my goodness.
With all the sequences. And I still had that for a long time. So there was the start, there was during the race, and there was the finish, and there was the coming back from, you know, the whole thing. So that took me the whole summer sitting down outside and drawing those things. So that, you know, that was my passion to do that. My father, in the meantime, he was working here in the same area, you know. And my father was, he was cute because he was trying to get us some food. And he got traps for birds that he put in a in a fumier. Come on,
in a manure pit.
Manure. So he had those traps in the manure things, and then at the end of the day there was about 6 or 7, 8 birds that was caught in the manure. So he would gather that thing, those birds, and my mother upstairs, she had to plug the birds, and she was roasting the birds for us to feed, because they were delicious. You have no idea. Those were the best. To me, you give me a turkey, I don't give a damn about the turkey. But those birds, my goodness, they were so good. You could eat everything, you know. So that was the occupation, the occupation of my father, to feed us and to make sure that we had. My father was a great guy, you know. He was, he was cutting trees in the park.
Wow.
Where he could get caught, and he put the piece of tree under the leaves, and bringing one piece every night on his bicycle. Oh my gosh, it was something. We survived, and thanks. But the taste of those birds, you have no idea how delicious they were.
Sounds delicious. Pev, when most people think of cartoonists, they think of political cartoonists. And I understand at one point in your career, you worked for Walter Annenberg, who owned both the Racing Form and the Philadelphia Inquirer, and he wanted you to give up racing to become a political cartoonist full time, and you said no. Tell us about that story and why.
Because I didn't say no. I said I cannot leave the racing cartoon. I want to do both, you know.
I think one of the things, too, is the paper soon got sold from Annenberg, I think, to Knight Ritter. And so I think at that point you had to make a decision. To go for one or the other. And and I want to point out that had my father decided to stay with the Philadelphia Inquirer with Knight Ritter, he probably have a wall full of Pulitzers at this point. A lot of other cartoonists have said so. And that might have been the loss of the political world, but our game, certainly, in horse racing.
Absolutely. I'm glad you didn't leave. And you got into the Hall of Fame last year. You're on the Joe Hirsch Honor Roll. And I know a lot of journalists out there and a lot of people that just type and write are just itching to get in there. But you were inducted last year. How was that? That's pretty amazing.
Because I paid them under the table.
You paid the right person.
I gave them, a few thousand dollars. And no. I don't know. I don't know how to answer that question. Really.
It's quite an honor, though.
And I think it's another fun fact is that, Dad, correct me if I'm wrong, but you actually started at the Morning Telegraph before Joe Hirsch, didn't you?
Yeah.
He was,
you mentioned Joe Hirsch, and I don't know if you see a caricature that did of Joe Hirsch.
No.
He was really a caricature. He was really a caricature. I love the guy. He was so good, you know. But he was like a pope, you know, like a pope. I saw that he was like a pope, you know. He had a little bit... He could be a pope, by the way, because he was hunched like that, and he was
maybe the wrong religion, but nonetheless. let me also jump in. I think it's important for a lot of viewers to know that one of the things that makes my father unique is the art of caricature, which now I want to make sure. People know that there are those caricaturists you might see at a party or at the shopping mall with the big head and the small body type of thing. But the art of caricature, the style my father adopted back in his youth, which you might see the famous cartoonist like Sem, S-E-M, and all that, who did a lot of sporting art kind of caricatures. That's pretty unique because it's not so. The way to show you how good he is as a caricaturist is that there are some people that my dad will draw, like when he drew Braulio Baeza as a jockey. And if you look at the drawing and you cover up the face of the jockey, you still know who it is just by the posture. And I think it was one of the great things of growing up is that my father would say, we'd be at Belmont or at Aqueduct. And he would say to me, there's a lot of very powerful people here, Whitney's and Vanderbilt's and a lot, but I'm the most powerful person here. And I'd say, why? I said, because I can make any one of these people stand up and run away. And I'd say, show me. And he would walk up with his pad and his pencil, and he would fake drawing, and she would get up and she would run away into the grandstand and not have a caricature. And he says, see?
So, Pat, on that subject, who are some of the favorite horses or people? Who did you just love to draw over the years?
Love to draw. You know, there are so many. I don't know if I can answer that because to me, I think it was fantastic to be given the gift of caricaturing people. You know, mm-hmm. I always try not to be mean with my caricature, except for a few guys that I can stand, but only a few. But usually try to get something out of the face that was funny, but also there was some kind of a gentleness about it. You know, I never wanted to be rude with people, except for a few women. That was.
Can we ask?
Oh, I think Zoe wants to know who those women were.
Women, yes, exactly. Who was it?
Yeah. I don't want to say that.
Okay. Good choice. Good choice. No. So I'll tell you what, my favorite cartoon that my father has done is actually, if you can see right over my shoulder right there, he gave this to me a couple of years ago. And maybe I'll do a screenshot of it and send it to you guys. But it's a caricature of Muhammad Ali, wow, that my father did on the back of a menu at a sports banquet in New York in 1966, yeah, before he fought Sonny Liston. And it's signed by Ali, who, yeah, notoriously would never, you know, sign anything. But he saw the drawing and he said, that's good. And so that's like my prized possession right there.
You have that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I stole it from you. You know, you didn't know, but I know.
Oh.
No, you gave it to me.
Yeah.
Bill, to your question, I think one of the important things, too, having worked in different facets of the industry over many years, it's so important that whether you're a trainer, a rider, a jockey, or you work as a journalist or management, I always tell a lot of the students that I teach at our community college, our equine studies program, always have an outlet, and also always keep a bit of a sense of humor, because oftentimes we get caught up in a lot of the important issues of our sport and our industry. But if you can't once in a while kind of take a step back and have a chuckle now and then, you're not going to last for a very long time. Or if you do, you're not going to be very happy. Right. So, right. And I think, yeah, that's an important thing that my father has been bringing to the industry for mm-hmm. quite a long time. And then mm-hmm. in whatever capacity now that I'm done shutting down racetracks, I'm like a cautionary tale. Bill and I go back to the Garden State days, you know, people at these conventions, yeah, they run away from me because I'm like Chief Dark Cloud. It's like Garden State, Hollywood Park, wow, Long Acres. So now I'm in a safe industry. I can't shut down any more racetracks. But it's important I'm glad I can, you know, bring a little bit of levity and sometimes an important point that people need to look at.
All right. So let's explain how this Balak versus Balak cartoon off is going to work. So what we're going to do is we're going to do time-lapse videos of the drawings that Remy and Peb did. We gave them a specific subject they both have to tackle, which is the 50th anniversary of Secretariat's Triple Crown win, perhaps his Preakness win. We'll see what they come up with, of course, with the anniversary of the Preakness coming up. So first, let's take a look at Remy's. And now let's take a look at Peb's. And to vote for your favorite and to be entered in a drawing to win that cartoon, go to Remy's Twitter feed, which is at Balak Remy, BellocRemi. Once again, Remy's Twitter feed is Balak Remy, at BellocRemi. follow him. You have to be a follower to win the drawing. Vote on the Twitter poll for the drawing you like best. The results will be announced on next week's show. And if your name is chosen, you will be given the original drawing won by the winner. So this has been a delightful conversation among everybody. Zoe, you got something you want to add to it?
Can I enter?
Of course you can. No, I don't think so. No. Friends and family of the TDN Writers Room are not eligible. Isn't that what they always say on these sort of things? So you're not eligible. Your family's not eligible. I'm not eligible. We're going to have Joe Fan win this. So maybe you can do a side deal with Pev and Remy for something like that.
I'm planning.
So anyways, Mr. and Mr. Bullock, it's been delightful. Thank you so much for being our guest. The Green Group guests of the week.
But if Remy win, I kill myself.
Now.
Don't do that.
Okay, take it easy on the old man, would you, Remy? Once again, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you all. Appreciate it.
As this week's guests of the week, Remy and Pierre Bullock will receive each a free 1-hour tax consultation from the Green Group, hoping to save them money on their taxes. For more information, log on to www.greenco.com.
Are you paying too much in taxes? The Green Group can help. There's a reason the most successful owners, breeders, and horsemen select the Green Group as their tax advisors. They save you money and share successful strategies. Over the past 40 years, the Green Group founder, Len Green, has owned and bred some of the best racehorses in the history of the sport, like Eclipse Award-winning champions Jaywalk and Wonderwheel. His DJ stable competes at the highest level and has received the game's most prestigious honors. Len Green's in-depth, hands-on industry knowledge, combined with cutting-edge tax-saving strategies, has produced positive results for his clientele and has made the Green Group the top-rated accounting and tax firm in the thoroughbred business. For a confidential and complimentary consultation, contact us at 732-634-5100 or visit our website at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
With some of the fullest fields in the country and quality racing year-round, there's never been a better time to reap the rewards of breeding and racing in Kentucky. Purse money in Kentucky is at an all-time high, as is average purse per race, outpacing California, Florida, and New York. Kentucky breds. Breed them. Raise them. Race them. We all win.
TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Kentucky Breds. The average purse per race in Kentucky, $77,126. Average, outpacing all leading racing jurisdictions, including Arkansas. We know the pots there have been crazy good. New York, California, and Florida. Additionally, over $200 million has been distributed to Kentucky breeders since 2006, with purse money soaring. And thanks to the Kentucky Thoroughbred Development Fund, some of the fullest fields in the country with quality racing year-round has been taking place in Kentucky. There is no better time to breed and race in the bluegrass. And as the Triple Crown season continues, all eyes here in Baltimore will be on the Kentucky Bred Mage, obviously winner of the Kentucky Derby, first Saturday in May, as he seeks to add the Preakness and go on to the Belmont Stakes with a chance to sweep the Triple Crown. Kentucky Breds have won a total of 103 runnings of the Preakness, including 8 in a row and 6 of the 8 this year, bred in Kentucky.
I think I speak for Randy and Zoe when I say, wouldn't you like to get through a podcast without having to do some bad news? And unfortunately, you know, we try to cover all the subjects. And once again, there was some bad news for horse racing. As everyone knows, Forte tested positive for a therapeutic medication called meloxicam after the hopeful last year. It didn't come out until it was leaked to the New York Times, which reported on it last week. And then shortly thereafter, there was finally some word from the New York Gaming Commission about what was going on here. There's a couple different subjects here that I want to tackle. I'll just throw two out. First of all, the fact that it took 8 months for this to be made public, to come out, and both sides have blamed one another. A lot of finger pointing here. I don't care who's at fault. I don't know who's at fault. It's inexcusable. And, you know, one thing I've said you know, imagine going back to baseball. Imagine if Mike Trout or Shohei Ohtani tested positive for steroids today, and the Major League Baseball announces it first time in the middle of next season. They'd be a laughingstock. And this is absolutely what happened here. Heise has said when they come in, it's going to be different. These things are going to be adjudicated much more frequently. The other thing, too, and you know, I hate to bash fellow journalists, and people may or may not know, I'm a Northeastern liberal left-wing guy. And I love
really?
The New York Times.
You are? I never knew that.
Prices you? Oh, my God. I think Bernie Sanders
kidding.
Is too right-wing. Anyway, but we've got a problem here. And in the here's the headline for the story. Trainer of one-time Derby favorite is disciplined in doping case. No, it was not a doping case. That is something they accused the New York Post or the National Enquirer of doing, sensationalizing the facts. Now, it's not good that this happened. Nobody wanted to see it happen. But, you know, people inside racing understand what's going on here. And it shouldn't have happened. I don't know what happened here. And Pletcher says it's environmental contamination. He said this drug was never in his barn. Never prescribed. But this is really bad journalism. And it's unfortunate because everyone else picks up on this. And this is the last thing horse racing needs. And they went back to it. They went, said, you know, a couple paragraphs. Doping and horse deaths have long plagued racing. Yes, they have. But this was not a horse death. This was not doping. You know, so anyways, you know, it's not good. And you know, Randy, you're a journalist in your writing days, and you know there's certain standards that you should everyone should live up to, and you know they twist this around and sensationalizing it. And I don't want to make excuses for horse racing because there's too many problems, and damn it, these things shouldn't happen in the first place. But I don't like the coverage of it.
If I was still in the newspaper business and they wrote a headline about Forte saying that you know. Derby favorite doped, I would probably show up at the newspaper office with a torch. It's just ridiculous that happens. Medina Spirit wasn't doped. Forte wasn't doped. It's a legal therapeutic medication that was that had, you know, obviously too much of it was in Forte's system when he won the hopeful. That's a far cry from doping trying to gain an advantage. Maybe I'm gullible. I think Todd Pletcher's a stand-up guy. I think if he had given the medication to Forte and just too much remained in his system, he would admit that. I mean, he comes out and just flat out says, we never gave this to Forte. Now, obviously, the split sample, you know, it was in his system. How it got in his system, what kind of contamination, who knows. But it does. It gives racing a black eye. But the biggest problem here, as you pointed out, it's not... Is it Pletcher's lawyers that were causing the problem? Is it New York authorities that were causing the problem? It's the system that allows this to linger and to fester for all this time in the shadows, as if we're trying to hide something with zero transparency. And it has to come out eventually in a New York Times article by Joe Gray. It's ridiculous. And I mean, Heise immediately jumped forward and showed the regulations that it will bring to the table if it's allowed to May 22nd. It's looking encouraging, but it has before when the medication thing kicks in for Heise, where this would not happen. I think they have a 30-day threshold or something like that to where it would have to be adjudicated. And there would be a provisional suspension for a trainer with a positive test right away. It's the way it ought to be. And that day, in my opinion, given what happened with Justify and the scopolamine positive and what happened to Forte now, can't come soon enough.
Yeah. I mean, that's just sensationalizing the lead. And whoever wrote that headline should just be shot, basically. We don't need any of that. And Todd Pletcher and the lawyers and everyone, they're all fighting over everything. They're probably going to continue to do it. But at the end of the day, what we're talking about is contamination. This is the biggest subject, never mind the headlines, that horse racing has to tackle. Where do you draw the line between contamination and something else? 500 picograms. A picogram is a trillionth of a gram. It's absolutely nothing. It's inconsequential. We need to have a threshold that horses can be okay with, because I think Todd did his due diligence and went through his whole barn and see if anyone was using that type of anti-inflammatory medication and went and looked for it. And it's like, you know, we've never given the horse that. And Todd is, he runs a very, very tight ship. And guys that run tight ships don't give the wrong kind of drugs. Now, do they push the envelope? Sure, they push the envelope. But if there's no envelope to be pushed, there's nothing to be pushed. So we need to do a better job with everything. And we need some journalists in the New York Times that like horse racing is what I really want right now, to be perfectly honest.
So yeah, I'm going to disagree with you, because it's not a journalist's job to like horse racing.
Correct.
That's the people in the industry, the people, the executives. It's a journalist's job to get the facts right and to write a credible story. So journalist's job is not to promote horse racing. If somebody writes a negative story about horse racing and they get the facts right, and I don't think they have an agenda, I have no problem with that. I've done that myself 10,000 times. So, you know, that would be my point on that. But, you know, again, it's just back to what Randy said, you know, the eight months thing, I don't know what to do but shake my head. Hopefully Heise will correct this, and it's not going to happen in 72 hours or 48 hours, but they promise they're putting an end to this sort of stuff. And that is a change that is very badly needed. All right, let's get on to the nicer subject. Zoe, who's the XBTV worker of the week?
Well, the XBTV worker of the week is Fazer, seen working here for Hall of Famer Bob Baffert. And she broke off about 10 lengths behind her company and just absolutely cruised along. I told you earlier about how the last race, the Santa Anita Oaks, had definitely pricked up her ears. Well, here she is. She starts drawing off from her workmate there. The horse, incidentally, who comes up beside her is a Mark Glatt trainee by the name of Agency, who was Bolt Doro's very first two-year-old winner. He's on the comeback trail and is a very, very nice three-year-old colt. So Fazer more than holding her own in the morning now as well as the afternoon, because before watching her work, she was just a horse. The XBTV workout of the week is Fazer. We'll be right back after these messages.
All the thrills, fraction of the bills, experience the power of the partnership. Change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by West Point Thoroughbreds, seen right here. Joining a West Point Thoroughbred partnership can vault you literally right into the winner's circle for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. Jace's Road may not have given West Point another Kentucky Derby, but they had two very promising allowance winners in the week. Randy, what can you tell me about Vava? Looks like she's pointing to the test for her next start for Cherie DeVoe.
Yeah, they gave Vava a chance at the fairgrounds to be a Kentucky Oaks-type filly. They ran her in the Untappable, then they ran her in the Rachel Alexandra. She caught Pretty Mischievous both times and was well beaten, like a filly that just didn't want to go around two turns. So they backed her up in distance. She had a nice 6.5 furlong allowance race at Keeneland, finishing second to Positano Sunset in a really fast race, and then came back on the Oaks undercard and won that allowance race really impressively with an 85 buyer speed figure. So in a year in which three-year-old fillies look to be among the weaker of the divisions, I think you'd have to give Vava a really close look when she comes back at Saratoga in the test.
And not only did they have Vava, Giant Game was grade one place in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile in 2021 and is rounding back to form at age four. He set all the pace in a Thursday allowance race to win for trainer Dale Romans. To learn more, visit westpointtb.com.
All right, guys, that's a wrap for this week's Preakness edition of the Thoroughbred Daily News Podcast. I want to thank my cohorts, Zoe Cadman and Randy Moss, taking some time out from their busy week at Pimlico for the Preakness. Our Green Group guests of the week, Remy and Pierre Bloch. All Pierre Bloch, of course, better known as Peb. Our assistant and associate producers, Katie Petruniak and Anthony LaRocca, as well as our editors, Leah LaRocca and Nathan Wilkinson. Enjoy the Preakness, everybody. We'll talk to you next week.